And welcome again to Brew Crew Online. I'm Benjamin Orr.
I'm Colin Bennett.
And man, it has been a month, hasn't it?
Since it has.
You know, you have the NLCS, ALCS, World Series, Baseball Fall League, all these crazy things going on in the off season. It's just, it's too much to handle at one time.
Yeah. And, you know, we throw in my broken laptop and and the fact that we're both terrible at predicting series, apparently.
Oh, God, yeah, I just...
Did we both pick the Tigers?
You know, I don't think I even had the Tigers in the World Series at one point. I think I still cling on to hope for the Yankees, but I definitely didn't see it being Giants-Tigers, and the fact that the Giants slipped in four was just... Nobody saw that.
No.
I mean...
I went back and looked at our preseason predictions... And for some reason, I had the Phillies in the series.
Get out.
I'm
done.
I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I was playing hypotheticals, and I thought, you know, the Phillies can definitely win that division or at least get into the wild card. And then I don't know what happened to me.
Did we all pick, or was it just, like, I forget if it was a collective thing. I can't remember.
Yeah, we all picked, like, it was like March that we all picked. So in March, it made sense that that division would come down to the Phillies and the Marlins, to me.
Real quick, before we actually start, who did, like, Lou have? Who did I have? Who did Kurt have? Like, how did that go?
Oh, I don't really remember. I think Lou had Milwaukee in the series. I know that. Lou had Milwaukee in Detroit. I remember that because he was the only one. I think Kurt was the closest, but I really don't remember. We're going to have to go back, and we're going to have to rehash that later.
Oh, I got to find it. It was a post you did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's bugging me now, because it makes you wonder, because like you said, I mean, the Phillies on paper look so good heading into this season. Well, sort of. I mean, you had the injuries to... Ryan Howard and Chase Utley, but I mean, other than that, I mean, that pitching staff should not just lose. It should win every single game.
I think I made that pick like a week before Ryan Howard got injured too.
Oh, it's funny how that works out, but okay, I'm into March and I can't find it, but I don't know.
We'll keep looking for it. We'll update towards the end of the show.
Okay, the first thing we're going to talk about today, out of the many things, because folks, this is going to be a long show. This is like when you repress things and they come out all at once. This is what's going to happen in this show. So, first thing we're going to talk about today is this giant monster, gargantuan, throw in a word there and it'll describe it, trade that happened last night between the Toronto Blue Jays and the Miami Marlins. I mean, it's just... crazy. The Marlins, they send Josh Johnson, Jose Reyes, Mark Burley, John Buck, and Emilio Bonifacio to the Jays. This has huge implications not only in the NL East, but in the AL East as well. And it's just, where do the Marlins go from here?
Yeah, and I was, if you follow us on Twitter, we were talking, I was talking to the editor of Marlins Maniac, our friends that hold down the Miami site. And, you know, on paper, it wasn't a bad baseball move necessarily. I mean, they did get Escobar back. They did get Escobar in return, plus some very good minor leaguers. So in terms of rebuilding baseball-wise, it wasn't a bad move. But in terms of PR, you got rid of people you spent a ton of money for just the year before. You know, and... you already got rid of Hanley, and now you get rid of Burley and Josh Johnson, the pitcher that everyone assumed was going to be the pitcher, you know, kind of that anchor there in Miami for a while. He had suffered through some injury and what have you and struggled a little bit last season, but, I mean, still an outstanding pitcher. And, I mean, you just blow up that team. You have a brand-new stadium, a brand-new look. You're starting a whole new franchise, essentially, now. It's it's crazy. It makes you think, definitely the tipping point for Marlins fans in terms of Loria's tenure as owner of the team. And it really, it just makes you wonder, you know, what do Marlins fans, have anymore in terms of loyalty to this team, in terms of, you know, confidence in their ownership. I mean, what's going to bring people to the stands next year?
Yeah, it's really crazy because, like you said, it's a terrible PR movement. It's just like, it's kind of like what Boston did in getting rid of Carl Crawford, Adrian Gonzalez, and Josh Beckett. And guys they spent a lot of money on to keep, and then they're gone within a year. I mean, the Marlins even have Jose Reyes, I think, for an entire year. I think he went to the Mets. He was with the Mets for a little bit. Then the Mets got rid of him, and he went to the Marlins. And you spend all this money on one guy, and then I just don't get it. I mean, is Ozzie Guillen going to be the next to go from the Marlins? Probably.
Right? I mean, oh, no, Ozzie Guillen was already fired.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Which, of course, we all saw that happening. And that was probably a good place to start and finish. I mean, Ozzie Guillen makes a terrific scapegoat. So there's no reason he wasn't going to get fired after a disappointing year. He always is. But it's just confusing, the whole thing. And it really, there aren't many things that make a lot of Brewer fans happy that we have Doug Melvin in place as a general manager, or, you know, and when an owner's doing a good job, you rarely think about them, but it really makes you happy to have to see a front office like Mark Attanasio, Gordash, and Doug Melvin, who make secure, rational moves for the future.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard because you don't see these long-term contracts being thrown around anymore as you used to, and it's interesting that a team like the Jays, who just have always been like an 81-81 team, never better, never worse than that, now
right.
have all this talent. And really, I don't really how much did they really give up to get them? I mean, they gave up a lot on the farm, but they gave up, you know, Escobar and Jeff Mathis, as we pointed out earlier. that breaks the bank right there if you don't trade Mathis. Him and his walker. But
Right.
No, I just don't really see how the Marlins rebound from this in a positive way. It might take years for them to rebound from this. And it's not like they were doing great with these guys anyway. But any hope they had has now squarely fallen under the shoulders of Giancarlo Stanton.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think, like, if you're a free agent now and the Marlins approach you, are you even interested?
Yeah. You have to ask yourself that. Are you interested at all?
Like, obviously, you know, the fans like to talk a lot about player loyalty, you know. Like, how could a player leave this team? And we'll use, like, Prince Fielder for an example. Like, how could Prince Fielder leave Milwaukee? You know, blah, blah, blah. Well, obviously, you want more money. And you want a chance to be part of a team that can win long term. Not that the Brewers can't, but obviously those are determining factors, and Prince felt comfortable in Detroit. But then you think about something that's not brought up a lot is franchise loyalty to players. And I think most people probably want to work in a place where they feel like the organization they work for believes in them. And obviously in Miami, they don't believe in anything right now.
Yeah, because you had that whole thing with the Dodgers when Frank McCourt was still there. And there was just not a lot of, you know, desire and wanting to play. It was just like, okay, we're getting paid to play, but we're not doing anything. We're not going anywhere. And
right.
You kind of ask yourself, have the Marlins really hit this point with this, with Jeffrey Loria? Have they hit the point to where they're just like, we give up. There's nothing we can play for. We're in a division that the Nationals are now good. The Braves still have life. The Mets are going to turn around sooner than later. And the Phillies can still be a threat. And you have the Marlins, who have literally just fallen into, like, Astro territory.
Right.
So, I mean, these fire sales that keep going on, I mean, this isn't going to be the last we're going to see. I guarantee you that. But this is probably the way it starts off, is this huge fire sale from Miami. Because
I feel like something this one-sided I haven't seen in a while, though.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't even really see that with the Boston trade, because I think the only big person that got traded in that was probably Adrian Gonzalez.
Right.
And I mean, the Red Sox did get James Loney in that trade. So, I mean, it's not like it was a total failure of a trade. James Loney's a pretty good first baseman.
Yeah.
But this trade, I just don't see. I mean, I don't even think Yunel Escobar qualifies to be traded for any one of those guys, to be quite honest. Maybe Buck, but I don't know other than that.
Yeah, and I mean, I can see Mark Burley for prospects. Maybe. Josh Johnson for prospects, definitely. I mean, individually, you could piece these together with, like, one for two here, one for three in the case of Jose Reyes, maybe, or Reyes Escobar and prospects. But, like, it's just weird. It's just a weird, weird situation.
Yeah, I just... Because I saw that last night, and I'm like, okay, wait, what? And I'm thinking... Wow, this is incredible how, because people were saying, well, you know, CeeLo's going to veto this, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, this isn't the NBA. I mean, David Stern's not going to come in and just be like, no. I mean, this stuff happens in the MLB, and it's crazy when it does.
Yahoo's resident mouthpiece, Jeff Passan, has officially come out and blamed Bud Selig for this, which... I guess I don't really care either way. I'll put it that way. I mean, yeah, there's an argument to be made that, like, oh, this is just, I mean, in some ways this is kind of an egregious move by an ownership team to just dismantle a franchise. But it's not like this hasn't happened to the Marlins before, A. And B, at the end of the day, as much as you can disagree with it, and as much as I may disagree with it, I mean, it's their money and it's their team, and if they want to dismantle their franchise, you know, the fans are going to vote. The fans are gonna vote for their team with their pocketbooks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, people that call for this kind of stuff are the same people that call for parody in the MLB, and parody in the MLB is such a joke. It's never going to happen, nor should it happen. That's, I mean, they're trying to level it out with the salary caps and things like that so teams don't overspend on players and try to make their team superstars, because we know how that works in the NBA with, you know, the Lakers so far. That was a joke, because they're 3-5. And
right.
Just a quick side note, why wouldn't you hire Phil Jackson? I really honestly would not care about him not going to road games. The fact that it's Phil Jackson, I mean, come on.
Right, Phil Jackson could coach from his living room, watching it on TNT. That's fine.
Yeah, I would not have a problem with that. But anyway, back to a sport that actually matters. It was just really interesting to see this go down, because a lot of people thought, well, it's not going to happen because it's such a huge blockbuster trade and it's so one-sided. Because I think the most interesting part about this trade is the fact that the Marlins traded Josh Johnson. I don't really feel like he needed to be traded. Burley, sure. Reyes, sure. Josh Johnson, no. I don't get that. Because you have a pitching staff that's kind of falling apart. You got that young kid, Nate Ivaldi from the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Who did so-so. But other than that, you don't really have anybody. You just traded away two veterans to this game. And... now you have nobody in this pitching staff. If you're going to keep one of them, I mean, by all means, try and keep Josh Johnson. It's not like he had a terrible year last year. He wasn't as sharp, but it wasn't a bad year. So, I mean, he had one year where his ERA was over 7, but that was only in 4 starts. So, I mean, it's not like Josh Johnson's a bad pitcher, and I think you're just kind of kicking the organization in the gut when you trade somebody like him.
I can guarantee you that through this season, you will see a few ownership groups come up out of Miami to try and take the Marlins away from Jeffrey Loria, which would not be a bad thing, by the way. There are people calling for Major League Baseball to force Loria to sell. That's coming from Buster Only. There aren't really any names attached to it, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's not surprising at all. And, I mean, that wouldn't be a bad idea either. I agree with you that, you know, complete parity in Major League Baseball is A, inattainable, and B, I don't even know if it's possible to set it up that way. But, you know, when things like this happen, when you have this, I mean, it's not even a trade per se. It's a complete dismantling of a franchise. It's hard to kind of just let that pass, you know?
It's almost like a joke, really. It really is, in a sense. It's exactly what we saw with the Dodgers and Frank McCourt, just in a grander scale of things. McCourt was suffocating the team, but he wasn't training people. Loria is just like, why not? Got nothing right. better to do. And people I've seen on Twitter actually calling for Mark Cuban to buy the team, because I remember how he had interest in the Dodgers. I'm like, why couldn't he buy the Marlins, you know? I mean, man has more money than yeah. he probably knows what to do with, so, I mean, it would be a good investment for him to do. But, yeah, you're definitely...
Mark Cuban would actually probably be a great benefit to baseball. The way that he's so in tune with his fans and everything in Dallas, mm-hmm. Him owning the Miami Marlins, I think, would be fantastic to see. I would love to watch it.
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of like a pipe dream for, like, just fans in general. I mean, you'd like to see that happen to increase the game a little bit. But I think you're right, though, in saying that the MLB is going to have to oust him at some point. They're going to have to oust Loria from that position, because he's just literally going to probably start trading hot dog vendors and, I don't know, people who work in the locker rooms next, and there's going to be nobody at this stadium. I mean, you buy this ridiculous stadium with fish tanks and I don't know what else, that weird thing in left field.
right.
And just... You get new uniforms, you change your name from Florida Marlins to Miami Marlins, you get all these players, and now it's all gone. It's all blowing up in your face. I mean, more and more we're seeing that a collection of talent like this and all this big stuff, it does not ever go well. It just doesn't. You
right.
can't I mean, you look at teams hypothetically on paper that should be good. The Philadelphia Phillies rotation, the Boston Red Sox of 2011. Teams that should be in the World Series every year, and they are the closest thing from it when the season ends. So I don't know why people still think having a huge collection of talent on one team is going to do well. It doesn't. It works in very few rare cases. And sometimes you look at it and you're like, wow, these guys, you know, he only made this much, you know, guys you think that should be these huge superstars and aren't, because they're so under the radar, because they're not, you know, the Jose Reyeses and the Adrian Gonzalez's of baseball. They're, you know, like, look at the Brewers. I mean, I don't even think Lucroy makes $1 million. And he's, in my mind, one of the best catchers in the game right now.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know if it's all a joke to Jeffrey Loria about this, but it's definitely something that's changed baseball heading into 2013. And not just for the Jays and the Marlins, but I mean for the entirety, for the other 28 teams.
Yeah, and on that note, I'm thinking, now that this has happened, and essentially a large portion of the talent in the southeastern United States is gone.
He's taking his talents away from South Beach.
Exactly. I can't believe no one said that yet. ESPN, I wish I had ESPN. I'm sure they'd have a field day with that. But, no, I mean, it makes me wonder, in terms of, you know, we're going to try to shift it back to Brewers focus a little bit.
That's what this is, a Brewers show?
Yeah, okay, it is not just ruin everyone in Miami's day. But, you know, I wonder... Does this have any effect on the market as a whole, in terms of trading, in terms of free agency, what have you? Do you think that it's going to cause any sort of major shift in the market now that a trade like this is opened up? Because generally speaking, you know, after the first trade, things really start to, you know, start to fall into place. People are more willing to make deals.
Mm-hmm. I think it makes waves in the AL East more than anything, because now you have Toronto, who is now a legitimate threat to make the playoffs. I mean, you cannot disagree with that at all. They had a good team, but it wasn't enough. Now they have that extra little push, and you have Baltimore, who made it to the wild card game. You have the Rays, who are a threat. You have the Red Sox, who, you know, they aren't going to be terrible forever. And then you have the Yankees. I think you'll see a lot of moves in the AL East. I don't know from who. But I think that's the division you'll see from the most. And I think it'll eventually ripple down into other divisions of baseball. But I think directly it's going to play into the NL East and the AL East more so than anything. Brewers-wise, you know, I wrote an article, I think last week or so, about, you know, let's kill the Josh Hamilton rumors because they're not happening. Now, I'm going to sound completely hypocritical when I say this, but what about Giancarlo Stanton and the Brewers? Is that possible? I don't know. I mean, it's something to think about and who we would give up for it. But, I mean, Stanton's young. He's a powerhouse. And who doesn't want that?
Right. And he doesn't want to be in Miami anymore. I think, generally speaking, I think if you're looking for, and the Brewers are looking for, veteran pitching, and everyone's always on the lookout for more offense. I think you have to start seriously considering Hart as a contender to be moved, because they're not talking extension right now for whatever reason, either because it's too early, because they want to see how he plays next season, or because they have some plan in the works to put him up on the market. You have to start considering him, even slightly. You know, the idea has to be in Hart's head, in Melvin's head, and in some of the fans, that he is a possibility to be moved. I mean, and it's not out of the question either to think that Carlos Gomez could be moved. And I know, you know, we all like Gomez. He hasn't reached his full potential yet. And that's a good thing in the trade market, because he's had some very bright spots last season. And he's not as consistently productive as we'd like him to be. In my mind, that makes him, you know, a guy with a high ceiling, a guy who's still very young, who can play multiple outfield positions, good speed on bases. If you're looking for a pure powerhouse, Carlos Gomez makes an interesting start to a package deal, I think.
Yeah, I think the Hart thing that you were talking about earlier definitely becomes more of a possibility, because it's something we talked about months ago. I mean, talking about in May and June, we talked about Hart could be a potential trade possibility. Yeah. Gomez, I'm not so sure about. I would like to keep Gomez based on his speed and the fact that he can hit, you know, pretty well. I mean, I think he had like a 260 average and I think over 10 home runs. And he can hit pretty well, I think. I don't want to trade him just yet. I think he needs to prove himself one more year to see, you know, to increase his value in the market. Because nobody really wants to take a gamble on a guy that you've only seen a little bit of. Because we didn't even know, heading into 2012, who was going to be the center fielder. Was it going to be Carlos Gomez? Was it going to be Nigel Morgan? Now we know, heading into 2013, provided Gomez isn't traded, it's Carlos Gomez because Nigel Morgan's gone.
Right.
The Hart thing, I think, definitely makes sense because... And it's not that we want to get rid of Corey Hart. We love him in Milwaukee. We don't want to see him go. But when it comes down to it, we have people that can take his place. I mean, we're going to see how Taylor Green does in the Dominican League this winter. You know, how he's doing right now and how he'll do till the end of December. We have Matt Gamble. I mean, and we can even, I think, possibly try to use maybe Maldonado at first. I don't think that's out of the question.
Right.
If we're going to have his bat in the lineup. There's a lot of possibilities, and I don't think... It's not that we want to get rid of Corey Hart, but it's in a way, if we got rid of him, it's a way we could benefit the team. And if we do that for starting pitching, good starting pitching, then I don't really see what's wrong with it, you know?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, really, Hart's over 30. He's going to be very expensive in an extension or in a brand new contract coming into free agency. And he's obviously he's losing a step defensively in the outfield. We've been fairly vocal critics of his play in right field, I'd say. I mean, looking at it realistically, I do like Hart. He still has plenty of talent, and he still has a very good spot on this team. But looking at it business-wise, if there are people that can use him and we can get something in return, there's no reason not to consider him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great addition to any lineup. I mean, he can still hit, you know, 30, not 300, but maybe 3080, 3090 with a 270 average. He's still a pretty decent player.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that is unattractive about Corey Hart is his salary, $10 million. Not a lot of teams are going to be jumping for that. But, I mean, he's not terrible in the outfield. He's not that great, but he's not terrible to where I wouldn't want to play him out there. Because
right.
that does add to his versatility between right field and first base. So that gives him more of a value on the market.
And he's getting to the point where he would become attractive with his play in first base. He would definitely become more attractive to an AL team.
Yeah, with the DH spot. I think that's why I thought that article I wrote about Jeremy Hellickson, you know, trading Hart for Hellickson made a little bit more sense, because you have him possibly be the DH, and that's something that the Rays need. So.
Yeah, yeah. And we have some offensive spots in the minor leagues that, you know, if we were doing, if they wouldn't go straight up Hart for Hellickson, which is as possible as it is not possible, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be some contract issues to work out and what have you, but putting a couple prospects like a Chris Davis or, you know, Kentrell Davis, bringing those guys along with them, some outfielders that have good potential, could definitely benefit both teams, I think.
Yeah, maybe even throw a Hunter Morris in there as well. I mean, I've heard his name thrown around a little bit if prospects are traded.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's all really subjective at this point, as is most speculation. But I think Hart is definitely the face of trade bait in Milwaukee right now. I don't see anybody else being that trade bait, not maybe because of the talent, but maybe sometimes sheer contracts, like Ricky Weeks. Nobody's really going to want that lesser production for that huge of a contract.
No, for better or worse, Ricky Weeks is ours until his contract runs out.
Yes. You know, and I think it's interesting, you look at the free agent market and who's out there. You know, Melvin has been talking with Greinke. Would love to have him back. Is it going to happen? I doubt it. But you never know. With Markham gone now, it opens up some money. The one pitcher I think the Brewers should keep their eyes open for, at least one of the two, because you're going to mention the one after I do, is Dan Herron. I know the Angels, you know, they're going to try to keep a lock on Greinke, because they just lost Irvin Santana to the Royals. Dan Heron's kind of in that midway now.
Which was a great pickup for Kansas City.
Oh, it was. It was tremendous. And he even said that, you know, he feels like a rookie again, because it feels like a fresh start for him. So, you know, best of luck to Irvin Santana in Kansas City. But I think Dan Heron's kind of in that middle ground right now between signing and then going to free agency.
Right.
I don't think he stays with the Angels. I think he goes somewhere else. And Milwaukee could be a great option for him. You know, he's kind of what we had in Markham, but a little bit better. He's faded off in the past year or so, but I don't think it's much of a concern.
Right.
Because I still think he would do well in the NL. He's pitched there before. He pitched with the Diamondbacks.
So. Yeah. And Herron would be a very interesting pickup for us. And the other one that the Brewers are interested in is Ryan Dempster. And Dempster is Dempster's an interesting idea because it's definitely workable, and we could definitely have him for a few years at a decent price. And if you know, and it's hard to tell with him because it's possible that the market oversold him because he was the biggest name coming out of the Cubs. You know, it's very possible that the market is kind of overselling him to, you know, to franchises. But he pitches well in Miller Park. He pitches well in NL Central. I don't see an issue with picking him up if we can get him.
I'm not opposed to it, but at the same time, I'm not hopping on board for it because everybody was so ecstatic last year. Like, oh my God, Ryan Dempster's pitching so well and Texas jumped up and grabbed him and then he did awful. And I'm thinking, I'm not getting excited about it because Ryan Dempster is not that type of pitcher. It's not like an R.A. Dickey season to where he's just dominant every start out. I mean, Ryan Dempster did good, and then we saw the actual Ryan Dempster, which is average. It's not bad. It's average. But I still think, like you said, Milwaukee has to at least try to make some sort of a stab for him. He's not the worst option out there. He has a lot of experience. like you said, he pitches well in Miller Park, and just imagine what it's going to be like if we get him and we go to Chicago, having Ryan Dempster and Aramis Ramirez on our side.
Right.
Imagine how they'll feel about that. So.
Yeah, that would be that would be interesting. Yeah, we're kind of in a strange limbo right now. I mean, there's plenty of people to go for. Rumors are swirling like crazy. Nico Farr of the Boston Globe came out just a couple days ago and said the Brewers are still a team to watch for Josh Hamilton. We still have interest in Ryan Dempster. There are plenty of people on the market. R.A. Dickey is either definitely going to be traded or not going to be traded at all. And he makes a very interesting option because the Mets need basically an entire team outside of wherever they decide to play David Wright. And if they even signed him. So, you know, there are a lot of November's kind of an interesting time in the major leagues, just because we haven't quite gotten to, you know, winter meetings are about a month away almost exactly now. So GMs are kind of just testing the waters right now, and then someone like Gloria comes in and blows up the whole system. It's and this year I think is an exciting time for the Brewers because we don't have a ton of money to spend, but we have a lot of interesting plays we can make.
The way I want to put this in an analogy is, like, you have the 29 GMs making a stack of cards, like a house has a stack of cards, and the warrior right. just comes in, slams the door, and throws his books down on the table, and the cards go everywhere. That's kind of what he just did.
Right.
And just, he really stirred up a lot with that, and that's why you see these crazy rumors, Brewers after Josh Hamilton, you know, Mariners after Josh Hamilton, and it's just things that... You think the signing Josh Hamilton to one of these teams would literally cost the team to get everybody rid off of their 40-man roster but this player. They wouldn't be able to afford him.
Right.
And I that's why I kind of want these Hamilton rumors to die, because it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I just don't think the Brewers will sign him.
Yeah.
Because they're thinking, oh, well, the hitting coach is there. But, yeah, how long is the hitting coach going to stay for the next 7 years?
I mean, come on. Right.
So, I mean, there's that. Just real quick, I did find that email with the predictions on it before we talk about more about free agency.
Oh, yeah, let's hear them.
Remember Steve that used to write with us?
Yes.
Here are his. He had AL East Yankees, AL Central Tigers, AL West Rangers, Wild Card 1 for the AL was Rays, Wild Card 2 is the Angels. For the National League, he had the East for the Phillies, the Central for the Cardinals, the West for the Diamondbacks, the Wild Card 1 for the Brewers, and the Nationals were the second Wild Card. Brad had the East going Yankees, Red Sox, Rays, Blue Jays, Orioles, Central, Tigers, AL West, Angels, East, and the NL was Phillies, NL Central was Cardinals, NL West was Diamondbacks. Oh, God, what did I have? I had Yankees, Tigers, Angels, Rays, Rangers, Braves, Cardinals, Diamondbacks, Brewers, Giants. And everybody thought I was crazy for saying the Braves. Hey, my playoffs were not too far off. Maybe a little bit. I had Angels versus Yankees, Tigers versus Rays, Yankees versus Tigers in the ALCS. So, hey, I got that right. In the NL, I had... Brewers and Giants in the wild card game, and the Giants won. And I had Braves versus Cardinals, which did happen.
Yeah.
And then Diamondbacks versus Giants. And then the NLCS was Braves versus Giants, and the World Series was Yankees versus Giants, and the Yankees winning in six. So, yeah, I was not too far off.
I'm sure I was embarrassingly far off.
Let's see. You had Yankees in the East, Tigers in the Central by a landslide, as you said. Angels in the West. You had the Mariners in last. Sorry, Lou. That's what you said. But hey, they didn't do that bad. NL Central, you had the Brewers. NL East, you had the Phillies. NL West, you had the Diamondbacks. Wild Cards, okay, yeah, this is getting a bit of a stretch here. You had the Blue Jays and the Rangers.
They seemed like they could do it.
And then on a wild card, you had the Marlins and the Reds. So that's all I can say about that.
Oh my god, it's terrible. I'm awful at this game.
I mean, I don't know what's more funny about that: the Reds losing the Central or the Marlins even making it. I mean, it just
on paper it seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, now we look at that and we're like, oh wow, that it's like a train wreck times four.
Right.
Well, I mean, at least it doesn't count for actually anything, because now's the time we're gonna laugh. I get to laugh at you for that, because that's just wow. I don't even know what we were thinking at some of the. I don't even see. I don't think Lou had one.
Well, and that's the fun of that's the fun of the baseball season, isn't it?
Oh my god, yes. That. I mean, I just look at that. I see Blue Jays and I see Marlins, and I'm like, what? The Blue Jays.
I didn't think it was that big of a deal in. Well, you know, in the early part of the season, I thought that it made sense to me.
Well, it's funny because you have the two teams that we were talking about for so long now, and the Blue Jays now are an actual threat. And the thing that really hurt them within the season was injuries. That's what really plagued them a lot, was a lot of pitching injuries for them. But
I will say that outside of the Marlins pick, it really was the teams that I picked probably would have been good if it weren't for the injuries.
You actually had the Nationals in fourth in the AL East, in the NL East, I'm sorry. Oh my god, this is your AL East. Yankees, Blue Jays, Red Sox, Rays, Orioles. Wow, you really thought highly of the Blue Jays. You had the Twins in second in the Central, and the White Sox in last.
Yep. I stand by that prediction, even though it worked out exactly opposite. Why are they so high on the Twins?
They have, like, nothing aside from Mauer and Morneau.
I think I was just trying to be provocative at that point.
You had the Royals in third. I mean, hey, that's something or other.
That didn't seem like a bad move on my part. It seemed like they were poised to make a move.
I mean, the rest
of... Coming into this season, that's not as bad of a pick.
You actually had the Pirates in fourth. You didn't have them in, like, last. So there's that. You're close on that. I'd say the closest division was probably the NL West, where you had the Diamondbacks in first, Dodgers in second. I mean, Dodgers in third, Giants in second, Rockies in fourth, Padres in fifth, and my inability to read. That provided quite a few laughs, so. Wow, you thought highly of the Blue Jays and the Twins. By a landslide, I don't know what constitutes as a landslide for you. The Tigers winning over the Twins in that division, but wow, I don't know why the White Sox were dead last though.
I honestly might have just forgotten about them.
Behind the Royals and the Indians, that just hurts.
The Indians made a good push last the season before that. And I thought if they could just sustain something, and then, of course, you know, they do their normal Indians baseball.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't give you an answer on that one. But, you know, and on paper, it really looked like, I mean, that was Detroit's division to lose the whole way. And, I mean, they ended up going to the World Series.
Yeah, I mean...
It just didn't work out that way in the season. But, In the beginning of the year, looking at that Tigers team, who does beat that Tigers team?
Yeah, I mean, you have the guy who just won Cy Young and MVP. You have Miguel Cabrera. You get Prince Fielder. I mean, that's a team that you can't mess with.
Right.
But the White Sox, I just didn't think they were that terrible.
No, they're not. And I don't understand why they weren't, like... I mean, third would have been a safe pick for them to be disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just... It's kind of funny, but in the same time, nobody knows, because nobody knew that Jake Peavy would have the season he did.
Right.
No, I mean, nobody knew that Philip Humber would throw a perfect game. Not that mattered, because he kind of fell apart after that, but,
A lot of people do.
Oh, God, that's what we should do for next year, is make predictions for perfect games. Have, like, the most ridiculous thing. Like, I don't know. God, I'm just trying to think, like... somebody from the Rockies was a perfect game.
We should do that.
Like Julius Chastain does a perfect game. Like the worst pitching staff in baseball.
Right.
I mean,
no, because, I mean, and that type of stuff happened. I mean, Dallas Braden threw a perfect game. He's not a terrible pitcher, but he's not been really outstanding since.
No, I mean, that's true. He's just been like, eh. But, all right, back to what we were talking about, which was free agency. I just happened to find that. I'm like, I have to bring this up now.
I had to get embarrassed. It happens.
Talking about free agency, we're talking about the Americans that are in free agency, but there's also four Japanese players that are aiming towards the MLB. You have a pitcher, Kouji Fujikawa from the Hanshin Tigers. And then you have infielders, I'm going to butcher this so bad, Hiroyuki Nakajima from the Cebu Lions, Kensuke Tanaka from the Nippon Ham Fighters, and Takeshi Hidakata from the Oryx Buffaloes. Hidakata is a catcher. Tanaka and Nakajima are infielders. And like I said, Fujikawa is a pitcher. Do you think there's any interest from the Brewers to go after Fujikawa? He's a 32-year-old pitcher. He's more of a closer, from what I've read, over 220 saves. But he's also done really well, he's a closer. I guess he could help the bullpen a little bit. He did compete in both Baseball World Classics in 2006 and 2009. And I don't think it's known whether or not he's competing in 2012 or 2013. I really can't read today, apparently. I know that the Yankees had interest in Nakajima, who's a shortstop, and the other two, Tanaka doesn't say what he plays, and Hidaka's a catcher. So I don't think the Brewers are going to go after any one of those guys, but I think Fujikawa makes an interesting case, considering the Brewers are trying to reconstruct their entire bullpen.
Fujikawa does make an interesting case. What's going to determine it is his posting fee, meaning, you know, the amount of money required to see a workout and the amount of money required, you know, in case he doesn't sign. And what he wants his role to be. Because obviously we have a closer. And I mean, he would make probably an excellent setup man, which would kind of shift the bullpen a little bit. And we have a guy in Olmsted who can make, that we've just signed, and I did a write up on him a little while ago, who would also make a decent setup man if his potential fleshes out. It's not quite, international free agents aren't quite like finding, you know, some semi-pro wunderkind or, like, you know, a college standout or something. I mean, there's real risk on the line financially if you give these guys a workout. So, but the success of Aoki in Milwaukee and his willingness to be part of this team in a market that you really wouldn't think would be a standout market for an international free agent, I mean, there's definitely something there. I don't know how much they'd be looking at him. Again, it depends on what his role is. If he's fine being a setup or a middle reliever, I would say if the price is right, there's no reason not to go for him. At 32, it makes it a little more dicey. But there's no reason. I mean, if the price is right, like I said, if the price is right and he's motivated to play in America and is fine with his role on the Brewers, there would be no reason to not give him a workout at an affordable price.
Yeah, he pitches a decent amount of innings in Japan. He's averaged, in 2011 he pitched 51. His 2012 stats are not up, but he did pitch in 2012. It's not, he wasn't out.
Right.
He's a very interesting case for a Brewers bullpen that is reconstructing. But like you said, it depends on whether or not he would rather be demoted from that closer role into a setup role. Which is interesting because he did have 41 saves in 2011 and had 5 holds. And he used to be a setup man. He had 46 holds in 2005, 30 holds in 2007, and he was still getting saves in those years. So he looks like he can be a little bit of, you know, mix and match. If Axford has problems, then you go to Fujikawa. if, you know, things like that. If Fujikawa has problems, then you go to Henderson. I mean, this bullpen, we don't want it to be a revolving door like it was last year. But the fact that Fujikawa has about 12 years experience in professional baseball already, regardless of the fact that it's in Japan, I think proves a lot, because that's what the big thing was about Darvish when he came over here, was that he had pitched since he was 18 professionally.
Right.
Whereas Fujikawa, he didn't pitch professionally at 18, but he pitched professionally at 19, didn't play at 20, and has played since he's been 21. I think that kind of exposure helps them.
Right.
And, you know, obviously he would go through the spring trainings and the things like that and get kind of warmed up to it. He wouldn't be thrown into this mess, you know, cold turkey. He'd be trying to warm up a little bit to it. Now, whether or not the Brewers want to make a stab for him, because the Brewers are trying to retain some money to maybe make a big splash in the market somewhere, we really don't know where. But
right.
I think Fujikawa presents an interesting case, really, for, you know, any team, but particularly those that, you know, need some solid relief. Maybe the Yankees need him, because with Soriano opting out and Mariano Rivera maybe coming back, maybe not, nobody knows.
Right.
The Dodgers could use bullpen help. You know, there are a lot of teams out there that could use solid bullpen help, and maybe Kyuji Fujikawa presents that, but we don't really know, because Japanese players are always such a gamble. But the thing about Japanese players is that, and I'm not saying this is a slant against American players, but they seem to be a little bit more durable when they age. I mean, they seem to pitch the same as they did when they were 26, when they're 36. So I don't know if really, age is really a factor with them.
There's the durability factor, definitely, which is why he doesn't present as much of an issue as, say, a 32-year-old pitcher from, you know, just Major League Baseball. And also, I mean, they do play the game differently. The Japanese game is built a lot more around, you know, taking different roles for the good of the team, doing that, that sort of thing. So, I mean, it wouldn't be impossible to say that he wouldn't be fine taking a setup role, you know? I mean, Aoki took a bench role at the beginning of the season with no issue at all. So, I mean, there's that to consider too. It's just, it'll be interesting to see. Like I said, there's a lot to discuss yet about how much money he's going to command, you know, and what his demands are for playing in America.
Mm-hmm.
But he's definitely an intriguing option at this point, and probably for the Brewers, out of all the Japanese free agents, he's probably the best option.
Yeah, there's nothing really wrong that I see with him. a lot of people were very high on him from what I've been reading. And, you know, it's going to be that. It's going to be the posting fee, like you said, because I'm sure he's not going to come cheap, seeing the numbers he's put up in Japan. But if you're Doug Melvin, I think you have to make somewhat of a stab for him. If he fits in. If he doesn't, then, you know, let's worry about something else. Let's try to get some starting pitching. Let's try to rework his bullpen the best we can. And I don't know, it's one of those things you see out there and you're like, okay, that's a little bit interesting, because the American market's getting a little bit smaller and smaller and smaller with, you know, guys you want to maybe sign for 2 or 3 years. And sometimes guys you sign, they're a little bit of a risk, like Joachim Soria from the Royals. He said he's primarily interested with going with the Yankees, but any other team that he would be interested in, I don't know if he'd be a closer, because he's been on and off with injury. He's been on and off with his struggles on the field. But he's still somebody I think would be valuable to a bullpen. I just don't know, if you look into the American markets, how much stock you want to invest in relievers that you're very unsure about. There are some top ones in the market right now, like Ryan Madsen and Soria, but other than that, it's kind of just falls off the face of the earth.
Right.
So, next thing we want to talk about is the awards that are going on. Monday was Rookie of the Year for AL and NL. Yesterday was Manager for AL and NL. Today is Cy Young Awards for AL and NL. Tomorrow is the last presentation with the MVP Awards for AL and NL. So, Let's start with Monday. AL Rookie of the Year, Mike Trout.
I don't think there's any question about that. Mike Trout is... Mike Trout is going to be... I won't say unanimous, because that's almost impossible in this day and age, but I will say that of all the players in any team in the AL, Mike Trout had the most value to the Angels. Miguel Cabrera will be in second. I don't think it'll be that close. But I think he does deserve a lot of votes. He'll get a few first place votes, but it's really Mike Trout's award this year.
Yeah, and I'm not huge on this stat. I don't think it's that valuable, in a sense. I mean, it has some value to it, sure, but WAR. Mike Trout's WAR was 10.7.
Right.
I mean, by far, Mike Trout was the best player in all of baseball this year. I mean, there's no doubting what he did.
And among advanced statistics, WAR is the be-all end-all discussion of player value, and there are a lot of sports writers that are turning to that more and more now. So I mean, in the WAR argument, you don't have a case for anyone else but Mike Trout.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think WAR should define how a player is and how good they are, but I think in this sense, it kind of does.
Right.
I think one of the most impressive things about Mike Trout was the fact that he stole 49 bases. It was only caught 5 times.
Yeah.
That is impressive. He, on-base percentage of .399, slugging percentage of 564, batting average .326. Obviously, he didn't match Miguel Cabrera in most categories, but the fact that he did this at 2021 and literally, I mean, just blew everybody out of the water in the AL was just incredible. Obviously, if this was any other year, obviously you have a very tight race between Cespedes and Darvish. Mike Trout proved to be Superman this year. He just really did. There is no other way to put that other than the fact that he meant a lot to the Angels, he meant a lot to the AL, and he meant a lot to MLB, because you see this youth now trying to make this movement to where you don't have to be in the minors for 3, 4, 5 years. If you're ready, you're ready. And Mike Trout is proving that handily.
Yeah, in some cases it is. I mean, it is fun. You have a rookie class this year that I think is among the best in a long time. I mean, you can look back and you have, Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays came up at the same time. You know, the rookie class that Hank Aaron came up with was pretty good, and you have, you have cases like that going back a long ways. But I mean, this is in the last few years, undisputed, I think, one of the best rookie classes in a long time. And the idea that, you know, bringing him up from the minors right away, like we did, or like the Nationals did with Strasburg and Harper, and like the Angels did with Trout, I think it's a slippery slope to some degree, because you do have cases where people are going to burn out, and obviously we have one great, tremendous year from Mike Trout under his belt, and you have good years from people like Yonder Alonso and Bryce Harper and Todd Frazier, who actually had service time in 2011 as well. But I mean, I don't want to put the cart before the horse with these guys, but it certainly looks like they're going to be outstanding for a very long time.
Something I just want to make note of real quick, and I mean, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the Angels have now had two Rookie of the Years that are fish, Trout and Salmon. Tim Salmon went right back in 1993. So I just wanted to point that out real quick.
Right. Now we'll get a haddock or a crappie, maybe.
Or a bass.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. NL Rookie of the Year, Bryce Harper.
Unfortunate.
It's not that I don't think Harper deserved it. I think he did. But I think Wade Miley deserved it more. And it's not that Bryce Harper is a bad player. It's not that he had a bad season. But he won it because he was 19. Let's face it. That's why he won it.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other reason why Bryce Harper should win this award.
I will go ahead and just say it flat out. I don't think Bryce Harper deserved Rookie of the Year.
No, he didn't. I think if he's 2 years older, 3 years older, he doesn't win this. I think Wade Miley wins it hands down. And Wade Miley was only four first-place votes behind Harper.
Right.
Which I think is kind of a shame. And Todd Frazier only got three. I'm happy that Bryce Harper won. I'm happy for him. But I'm not happy enough about it because I think Wade Miley did so much better.
I'm not happy that Bryce Harper won at all. I think it was,
In
a way it was like, it was almost like a campaign from the sports writers to give him this award.
Well, I mean, I'm happy for him because it's a thrill as a 19-year-old to win that. I mean, there's no doubt, well, it's 20 now. But, I mean, it's a thrill to win that. But I don't think he should have beaten out Wade Miley. I'm happy for him, but I would have been happier if Wade Miley would have won.
I'm not even sure that he should have been a finalist, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, yeah, I can be happy for him that he won. Like, that's great for him. But, I mean, I just don't think the numbers bear it out. Wade Miley, being a starting pitcher, had a lot more riding on him, I think, than Bryce Harper did. And you can say Bryce Harper was, I mean, a big part of the Nationals winning season. Yes, sure. But, it's not like Bryce Harper came in and did for the Nationals what Trout did for the Angels. He wasn't quite the same spark that Todd Frazier was for the Cincinnati Reds. It's, in my opinion, and this isn't really even hometown bias, I think it really should have been the finalists in the 1-2-3 should have been Wade Miley winning, Todd Frazier, and Norichika Aoki.
Yeah, I mean, Aoki really didn't do anything else different that Harper didn't do. I mean, if anything, I think the only thing Harper beat him out in was home runs. So, I mean, unless you're going on that stat, which is really, really stupid, do you just go on home runs alone? Harper, if he did beat Aoki anything, it wasn't by much.
I think it was slugging and OPS. He was above him.
Yeah, I'll go out and say this. I don't think Harper's value to the Nationals was as valuable as Miley's was to the Diamondbacks. I still think the Nationals make the playoffs with or without Bryce Harper. I don't think the Diamondbacks make that same push they made without Wade Miley. He was the undisputed ace of the Diamondback staff in 2012.
Right.
There's just no way the Diamondbacks get anywhere near where they were without Wade Miley. And people would be like, oh, well, you're only saying that because he won 16 games. No, I'm not. He had a 3.33 ERA. He pitched. He was 5 1/3 innings below 200 innings pitched, and he only started in 29 games. That's really impressive.
Right.
His opponents had a 255 batting average against him. And if you want to get more specific about it, because I know people do, he dominated left-handed pitching, left-handed batting. Left-handed batting batted 200 against him.
Right.
He has phenomenal stuff. And it's kind of sad that it had to go largely unnoticed because Harper had to win the NL Rookie of the Year. I'm not happy with it at all. I definitely think Trout deserved Rookie of the Year, but hands down. I don't think Harper deserved it. I think Harper was just given the award.
Well, I think what's making me the most upset about it, and you guys listening can read the article I posted yesterday on it, is that this was more of a mandate about how the writers felt about Bryce Harper than how Bryce Harper played. And there was a steady campaign coming out of the Washington papers, coming out of national publications, is that people think that Bryce Harper is this new breed of, like, hardworking, all-out hustle, game changer that we're not currently seeing in Major League Baseball, which I don't buy. I don't know. I mean, Bryce Harper's still very temperamental. He's still very streaky. He's still very young. I mean, let's not forget, I mean, he finished the year hitting 270. He didn't do great in the playoffs. And I mean, that's not really evidence against his case necessarily, because Trout didn't even get to the playoffs. But, you know, nor did Wade Miley or really anyone else, except for, Cespedes in Major League Baseball. But, you know, it seemed to be more of a campaign for Bryce Harper based on the emotions that he evoked rather than his actual play, which I think is unfortunate, really.
A thing about Harper that a lot of people don't really see, because they'll see how well he did, you know, offensively, is he has terrible plate discipline.
He does. He struck out almost 23% of his at-bats.
He has awful plate discipline. I'll watch when the Nationals are on, and he'll swing a ball at the first pitch. He'll swing at the second pitch, and he'll strike out because he's swinging everything. And then he gets frustrated and throws his bat and throws his helmet because he's immature as a player. I say that because he's young.
And I mean, these are things that can get fixed easily. His plate discipline can easily come around. The temperament, you know, it's going to swing into routine. It's 162 games a year. I mean, he's not going to be able to have that, you know, try to stretch every single into a double, try to stretch every double into a triple. You know, he's not going to be able to sustain that for that long. And he's still going to be an outstanding player. I don't want people to think that this is, you know, hate on Bryce Harper hour.
No,
it's not. He just didn't deserve this award this year.
No, I will on the record, I will say I am a Bryce Harper fan. I think the kid is, I say kid, he's a month older than me. I think he's going to be a phenomenal player someday. He's going to be a great player that will mean a lot to whatever team he's with, whether it be the Nationals or somebody else. But I just think, and I want to clarify my calling him an immature player. Yes, it is because he's young. It's because he doesn't know how to control his emotions. It's because he swings at everything he sees.
And because he's always been a big fish.
But
he's always been a big fish in a small pond. I mean, he really has.
But you have to admire the stretching singles into doubles, though. The hustle he gives. You have to kind of... I tip my hat to that. He does play his heart out. He reminds me almost a little bit of Dustin Pedroia, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dustin Pedroia will do the same things, and Dustin Pedroia is almost 30. He'll throw his bat, throw his helmet, he'll knock the Gatorade cooler over because he struck out. But Dustin Pedroia gives 110% when he goes out there, and I think Harper is the same type of player. But I don't think he deserves NL Rookie of the Year. I think if you have to go on anything, it's how much one player means to their team. And how much they did overall. And I think overall, Wade Miley did better. Now, obviously, he didn't have the same numbers that Jeremy Hellickson had when he won it in 2011 as a pitcher.
Right.
But I still think, like I said, without Wade Miley, the Diamondbacks aren't even close to trying coming back in that division or even through the wild card. With him, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And like I said, time will tell on Bryce Harper and Mike Trout and Cespedes and Yonder Alonso, who I thought deserved a lot more votes than he got. I mean, just plugging away in San Diego, of all places. and, I mean, put up very good numbers for a rookie playing really against all the odds in San Diego. It should have got a little more recognition. And, I mean, Rookie of the Year is one of those things where it's like, it doesn't always pan out to be, like, spectacular players, so it's not a huge deal if you don't get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are literally hundreds of great players in the history of baseball who have never won Rookie of the Year. This year, it seemed to be more of a, at least in the NL, it was a referendum on hype rather than it was anything about what was actually happening on the field.
You know, and if you want to bring up, you know, talking about you mentioned Yonder Alonso from the San Diego Padres, and I think that's mainly because he played for the Padres.
Right.
It was noticed. But there's one person in particular I want to bring up that I think if he had played longer, if he was called up earlier and not in July, if he was called up in, say, maybe May or so, would have made a world of difference, was Josh Rutledge from the Colorado Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
Rutledge did amazing, and he goes highly unnoticed.
Yeah.
I feel like people were so obsessed with Bryce Harper that they forgot that there were other rookies that were doing just as good. I mean, he played in 73 games, had 37 RBIs, 7 stolen bases, 8 home runs, and was batting .274 with a .306 on-base percentage and a .469 slugging. Versatile infielder, obviously was playing because of the injury to Troy Tulowitzki, but if you're trying to make a case against Rutledge and for Harper, I think you're kind of running on nothing, because you put Rutledge a month or two earlier into this season, and I think he has better numbers than Harper at the end. I really do.
Probably.
I just don't see it. I just don't get how people were just so enamored by what Harper did that they forgot about him. I mean,
well, it's like I said, it's something that I've brought up a couple times. The people that the sports writers and the networks talk about are the people that become the people that we care about, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, that does make sense, but it's just, I'm not saying Harper's going to fade into irrelevancy after this season's over, but the one thing that I think is a little bit interesting about between Rutledge and Harper, though, is Harper had about 200 or so more at-bats than Rutledge, and only had, 60 or so more hits.
It's like right.
68 more hits. I would bet money, like a lot of money, that if, because Harper had 533 at-bats, whereas Rutledge has 277. If Rutledge had 533, I guarantee you he'd be way past the 144 hits that Bryce Harper had. I guarantee it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I think he's going to be a heck of a player, both of them. But, I think we need to get our steam out about the NL Rookie of the Year, because I just don't really understand why he was just given it. I think it's a shame that you just give it to him. I think you have players like Todd Frazier, who meant a lot to Cincinnati, who just go completely unnoticed. Because people are like, oh yeah, you know, he's a finalist, but is he really? I mean, at that point, we all kind of knew Harper was going to win it. We just didn't know by how much.
Right.
So.
And that's kind of, with the Baseball Writers Association coming out with this new, like, finalist format, at least in the Rookie of the Year and the Managers of the Year, it really just came out, like, straight down 1-2-3. And it kind of ruined some of the fun for me as someone who doesn't have an inside track, as someone who, you know, kind of enjoys looking at the debate and, you know, relishes in some of the arguments. It kind of took that away a little bit.
Yeah, because you start to speculate a little bit more, like, oh, this guy's going to be in here. But then you know who it is, you know, 1-2-3 in a uniform order. It's just like, oh, well, that kind of sucks. I know Aoki came in fifth, though, overall.
Yes, Aoki did come in fifth. A good showing, I think. I think he deserved to be a finalist if we're going to accept the legitimacy of the finalist format.
Yeah.
But, you know, really when you think about it, when you think about what the Brewers did and, you know, Aoki's not the prototypical rookie you want to talk about. Not a lot of power projection. He's 30. He already played overseas professionally. He really didn't stand much of a chance in the face of the writers in terms of being a finalist unless he went, like, Ichiro Suzuki on everybody his first year in Major League Baseball.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. But, you know, I think he did really well, and I think if we really want to talk about the type of player that baseball needs in the argument that, you know, many of the prominent writers and analysts want to have about Harper and Trout, I think you have to make a legitimate case for Aoki in that discussion, because there's a guy who literally did everything he could for Milwaukee, of all places. You know, and I mean, a 30-year-old guy who's still legging out ground ball singles to the second base and beating them out, by the way. a guy that, you know, doesn't make spectacular diving catches all the time and is just always in position to make outs. You want to talk about playing the game the right way. You look at the way Aoki plays, and, I mean, that's it.
Yeah, you can't really ask for much more solid production from Aoki because, you know, obviously there is that difference between Japanese baseball and American baseball. And a lot of people were wondering, well, should we even qualify, you know, Yu Darvish and Norichika Aoki to be Rookie of the Years? And I'm thinking, well, why not? It's their first year in America. They're rookies here.
Right.
And, you know, you factor in the things that Aoki did. He wasn't spectacular in really any stretch of the imagination, but he was still a very solid player for the Brewers and one we're going to want to hold on to for the next 3, 4, 5 years. Because mm-hmm. I think he's going to be able to do a lot for us. You know, is he going to win MVP? No. I don't see that happening. Is he going to win a batting title? No. Is he going to win a Gold Glove? Maybe, if the Brewers will stop getting snubbed for, you know, for the past 30 years.
Right, which is a whole nother discussion. Jesus.
I mean, I don't know how you snub Ryan Braun. I made an article about it not too long ago. I think it was end of October, looking at Carlos Gonzalez's numbers compared to Ryan Braun's numbers. And it's just, I don't know how he wins over that. And I almost made the thing for Chase Headley and Ramos Ramirez. That one was a little bit more close, whereas Braun and Gonzalez wasn't even. I don't even get that.
Yeah, I'm fine with Rami not winning it. Ryan Braun not winning it is kind of interesting, I think.
I mean, if you get, you know, farther into details, I use FanGraphs sometimes to, when I write articles. I use specifically for outfielders, mainly is UZR, Ultimate Zone Rating.
The Ultimate Zone Rating, yeah.
Ryan Braun had an Ultimate Zone Rating of 2.8. Carlos Gonzalez had an Ultimate Zone Rating of -8.5. And he also played in 20 less games than Braun, which is almost 200 innings less.
Right.
I don't get that.
Well, and this year the awards are going to escape Ryan Braun, strictly because of his original failed test.
Yeah, that.
And whether or not you want to agree with it, I know that an overturned suspension isn't the same thing as being proven innocent. But I have to assume he was tested a lot this season. I have to assume he was tested multiple times the year that he failed. You know, I don't know. I guess is the thing. I don't know, so I have to take the benefit of the doubt. And it's a shame, really, because Ryan Braun's coming, you know, had this case during kind of the twilight years of the steroid discussion. And, you know, a lot of the sports writers aren't ready to give up that ghost. You know, they're still going to dangle the carrot in front of people, make them a finalist for something, you know, make them in the discussion for the award and never give them that award, which I think is almost childish, but, you know, and it's unfortunate because Ryan Braun can play the rest of his career flat out, balls to the wall, 100%, and may not ever get anything again.
Yeah, this is actually a discussion I want to bring up a little bit later in the show, because I feel like this could be another topic as well. The one thing I wanted to mention was, did you know that the guy from Breaking Bad is now the coach for the Rockies, though? Walter Weiss? Walter White?
Yeah.
I saw that, I'm like, oh my god. And then the not Buster Olney guy, the tripping Olney guy on Twitter, if any of you follow him, he's hilarious.
You should. It's a must follow.
He's like, Jesse Pinkman's now the bench coach for the Colorado Rockies. And I saw that, and I'm thinking, wait, what? That doesn't make any sense. And then I saw that they hired this guy named Walt Weiss, and, you know, Walter White from Breaking Bad, which is a really good show, by the way. I'm fully endorsing that. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. But we were still talking about the awards. Now we're moving on to AL and NL Cy Young, which have not been announced, but they will be announced later today. AL Cy Young will be announced at 6:17 p.m., which is so stupid. Just make it 6:20 and 6:40, but whatever. Anyway, 6:17 p.m. Eastern Time, 5:17 Central. So NL Cy Young will be announced at 6:47 p.m., 5:47 Central Time. Same thing tomorrow with the MVPs. So let's start in the AL. Who is your AL Cy Young this year, Colin?
I think it has to be David Price, personally. He was just outstanding, and I mean, Verlander was good, Weaver was good. I like David Price. maybe it's kind of a bias. I like the way he pitches. I like the way he handles games, but I think it's hard to bet against him.
I have to agree there. I am fully for David Price. You know, you could make the case for Justin Verlander. You really could, but David Price is just more impressive, in my opinion. He pitches on a team that virtually gives him no run support, and he still managed to win 20 games.
Right.
I don't go and win solely alone. He had a lower ERA than Verlander. The Verlander did beat him out in almost every other category. I just think that David Price was just flat out impressive. And that's the thing, is the fact that you don't have a Miguel Cabrera and a Prince Fielder and a Delmon Young and a Andy Dierks on the Tampa Bay Rays. You have Ben Zobrist and a hurt Evan Longoria. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the same things that David Price, Justin Verlander has. You don't have that soft AL Central schedule and division. You're playing against the Yankees and the Orioles and the Blue Jays and the Red Sox. And that division just likes to eat at each other so much. They're so competitive with each other. And David Price knows that. That's why I think he wins.
Right.
According to ESPN panelists, because ESPN's so reliable at times. sarcasm there. They have David Price winning with 16 votes, Verlander in second place with 13, and Jared Weaver in third with no votes. I think it's a bit interesting that Felix Hernandez wasn't a finalist, but, you know, whatever.
Right.
We just had a whole discussion about the finalist thing and how it's crap. But I definitely think Price should win it. Will he win it? Probably not. I'll probably go to Verlander. But Price builds a very interesting case to win the Cy Young this year.
Yeah. I think the AL race, well, both races are pretty wide open. But I just think I really like the case for David Price in Tampa Bay. And in the National League, I'm going to go ahead and fully endorse R.A. Dickey for that Cy Young.
That's what I say, too. R.A. Dickey has to win.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, otherwise, if he doesn't win, you know what's going to happen? You're going to see a repeat of last year. Kershaw's going to win in the NL. Verlander's going to win in the AL. I honestly think that if R.A. Dickey doesn't win this award, there's something wrong with baseball. There's something wrong with the writers. Because, yeah, he has, you know, a .2 higher ERA than Kershaw. Ooh, big deal.
He won 20 games on an under 500 team, R.A. Dickey did.
And how many games... He had, like, how many one-hitters and how many complete games, and I think a few shutouts thrown in there.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You have a team that's basically R.A. Dickey and David Wright, that's it. And you're going to discredit him because of, you know, like a stat like ERA or something. I'm not saying it should be a huge thing, but I mean, that jump between Kershaw's ERA and Dickey's ERA isn't that significant for me to want to give Kershaw the Cy Young hands down.
Right.
Dickey was just flat out impressive. And being, I think, what, 37, 38, for him to just find that knuckleball that, you know, the only pitcher we've really known that had thrown the knuckleball primarily was Tim Wakefield, and he was not that great of a pitcher. I mean, he was a good pitcher, but he wasn't, like, phenomenal. And R.A. Dickey just made use of that. And R.A. Dickey made batters look silly this year with that knuckleball. He really did. Batters would chase the thing, and, like, they would swing up, and they're about to be flying into space because the ball is just down on earth. Because the deception he has on that pitch was just incredible. Will he do it again next year? I doubt it.
The knuckleball's not too taxing on the arm, It's actually not taxing at all. You barely use your arm. It's more of a shoulder pitch. And if you know his story, you know, growing up, his childhood, everything that he had to go through in the majors, in the minors and everything like that, he is, he's really, really, really worked hard, and he's pushed himself to the limit, especially this year. And I mean, to play that flat out unbelievable in, you know, for the Mets, 5 complete games and 3 shutouts, by the way. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah, and a lot of that he did back-to-back. Which is really impressive. I'm not saying that he's going to do bad next year. I just don't know if he'll have a Cy Young season next year, but I think he'll do fine, whether he's with the Mets or whatever team, he's with. Maybe the Brewers. Who knows? But you know what would happen if we got him and Dumpster? We would start hearing, no Country for Old Men jokes. We'd start hearing this. Let's just bring in Roy Oswalt as well.
Right.
But seriously, though, Dickey looked like he was 27 and not 37 this year. It just...
Yeah.
He just looked flat-out impressive. And, like I said, if he doesn't win it, then there's something wrong with baseball. I think it's actually interesting in the NL, though, because you have 4 finalists. Dickey, Kershaw, Gio Gonzalez, a 21-game winner for the Nationals, and Craig Kimbrel from the Braves. I can't even talk. My brain's just like trying to move before my mouth, which happens quite a lot, actually. That and Craig Kimbrel is not an easy name to say. I mean, try saying that 5 times fast. That's not easy.
Right.
But Kimbrel really presents an interesting case as a closer. He's 23 or 24 and already has 89 saves. He had a season that was eerily similar to Dennis Eckersley's 1992. Not as many innings pitched, but still really good numbers.
Right.
I mean, if Dickey doesn't have the season he does, and I know this is a lot of ifs here, if Dickey doesn't have the season he does, and Gonzalez doesn't win the 21 games, does Kimbrel get more of a shot to win the Cy Young against Kershaw?
I think he has an interesting case. I think lately writers have been sort of against relievers into the Cy Young race. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think... you have more of an impressive resume when you talk about starting pitchers, because they have to work through a whole lineup multiple times, where a closer, although not necessarily all the time, if the game works out the way it works out, when you have, 3 runs or you have a tying run on base or whatever it is, you're generally looking at bottom halves of the lineup in the 9th inning. You're certainly dealing with pressure. But I think writers tend to go more with starters, because starters, you have a larger resume in the season. You have more consistent pressure from opponents, and you have a chance to have more spectacular performances. That's nothing against closers per se. It's just kind of the way things work out for them. But I think Kimbrel would have to be in the discussion if you don't have R.A. Dickey, or you don't have Gio Gonzalez, or even if you don't have Kershaw in there. I think Kimbrel would be an excellent choice to add to that discussion.
Yeah, I think if maybe he gets the 50 save mark, then he definitely gets a lot more attention.
I think as a closer, you have to legitimately blow people away.
Yeah, and that's what Dennis Eckersley did in 1992 when he won it. Didn't he win MVP as well, I believe?
You might be right. I'd have to double check that. And also you have Raleigh Fingers as a Cy Young.
But, it's been fairly impressive, really, NL pitching. And NL pitching has, through the past few years, been better than AL pitching. And I think Craig Kimbrel really breeds a new line of closers into this game. there's always talk, you know, that nobody ever catch Trevor Hoffman, and then Mariano Rivera did. Now there's a talk that anybody can catch Mariano Rivera, and could that someone very well be Craig Kimbrell? Could he very well get to 600 saves someday, provided he has these 35, you know, 40 save seasons, you know, consistently,
right,
and doesn't lose his job in the you know, near future? If he continues on this path, obviously the Braves are going to want to lock him down. Does he get to this point sometime in his career?
You know, I think there's a legitimate case for that. I think there's, you know, for closers, generally when you're talking about Mariano Rivera's and you're talking about Trevor Hoffman's, you're talking about a big peak, sort of in their middle career, and then they hit this level of a high level of consistency going forward. And that's really what you look for more, I think, in terms of like record breaking closers, consistent longevity. And you can definitely see that in Kimbrel. There are a couple other closers out there that could probably do it. I mean, Francisco Rodriguez is one that before coming to Milwaukee, probably was in the discussion for that. Obviously things have gone not his way, but, you know, I would say Kimbrel's probably in line to be that guy.
I think that's very fair to say about him because, you know, it was impressive seeing what he did last year, tying John Axford for saves, and then this year kind of being the front runner really in the NL closer-wise. And just, if his saves don't impress you, his ERA should. 1.01.
Right.
Incredible. he's a closer with a 3.2 WAR.
Right.
Now that says something. All right, last discussion we want to talk about, at least award-wise, is obviously AL MVP and NL MVP. Colin, who has your vote for AL MVP?
Mike Trout.
No, Miggy's not thrown in there at all? No.
Miggy's thrown in there as a very close second. Well, I won't say very close. I think you throw caution to the wind and you give the young guy another piece of hardware. I had a phenomenal year. I don't think there's any question that he was one of the best players in the American League this year. I mean, there is a case to be made for the Triple Crown, certainly. He is, and Miggy's a fantastic player, has been for a long time, but I think this year, if we go by how the writers are working this year, I think it's Trout.
Yeah, I had to agree there. I think Mike Trout wins it hands down. I don't think it's going to be as unanimous as the AL Rookie of the Year was.
Right.
But the thing for Miguel Cabrera is, I don't want to say this because his career is far from over, but the way it's been going, though, is I feel like he's going to be that guy who gets to the MVP race but actually never wins it.
Right.
I feel like he's going to be like Dan Marino in a sense. Never wins a Super Bowl, but will still be one of the greatest in the game.
Right.
And you really hate to see that with a guy like Miguel Cabrera. I mean, he did win the Triple Crown, which is something that hadn't been done in 45 years. Which people try to say that's an award on its own, which it is, but so was, you know, MVP. But
so was the batting title, which Buster Posey won because Melky decided he didn't believe in math anymore.
But, I think that Trout wins it. There's really no reason as to why he doesn't win it. If you want to go based on defensive numbers, which they never do,
mm-hmm.
Trout blows Cabrera out of the water easily.
Yeah.
I don't really see that race really being as close as the NL. In the NL, this is what I hate, is having to take the playoffs, if your team makes the playoffs, into consideration.
Right.
Because if you do that, then there's only one winner, and it's going to be Buster Posey. But if you don't, but if you take that out of consideration, then you have Andrew McCutchen, you have Ryan Braun. I think Yadier Molina is going to be thrown in there somewhere. But that way, the NL becomes a lot more close than it already is. I think if it does factor into that way where it has to have the playoffs in, then Buster Posey wins, in my opinion. If it doesn't, then Ryan Braun has to win.
I think if you either with the playoffs in or the playoffs out, you have a legitimate case for Buster Posey. because I mean, Buster Posey didn't just have a great year on the San Francisco Giants. He didn't just have a great year as a catcher, which is also a big part of it, the positional argument. Buster Posey had a great year as a ball player who just happens to play catcher. I mean, legitimately. So I would not have a problem if Buster Posey wins the award. I know we've had discussions on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, email and everything about this. But I would like Ryan Braun to be considered, and he is being heavily considered, obviously, as a finalist, and I think that's great. I think Buster Posey deserves this award every bit as much as Ryan Braun. I would be fantastically happy to see Ryan Braun be given this award based on the fact that he was consistently productive at a high level and really a very, very, very valuable part of this team. But, you know, when you look at Buster Posey's numbers just across the board, I mean, he's also pretty fantastic. And I think Andrew McCutchen did great as well. But I think, unfortunately for him, he's kind of been also ran in this discussion because the Pirates floundered rather spectacularly.
Yeah, and Andrew McCutchen, even if he doesn't win it, which he probably won't, he did win the Gold Glove and Silver Slugger, which is very impressive, you know, mm-hmm. for a Pirate. Andrew McCutchen's always kind of... I still even think to this day, Andrew McCutchen flies under the radar in the MLB, generally.
Yeah.
I really think he does, which is such a shame because he's such a talent. But getting into back between Posey and Braun, I mean, I have to agree, I don't really have a problem if Posey wins, but I feel if he does win, it's going to be because of what happened in the offseason with Braun.
Yeah.
I really think that plays a huge factor into it. I really think that's why Braun won't win it. Because you can't dismiss anything Braun did. I mean, 40 home runs, 30 saves, 30-30 club, 112 RBIs. I just... You can't ask for better production from one player. He literally carried the Brewers on his back for a good solid month until the rest of the team decided they wanted to hit. Posey is complemented with average to okay hitting and amazing pitching. Something Ryan Braun sort of has with the offense, but not so much with the pitching.
Right.
But I'm not discrediting what Buster Posey has done at all in 2012, or even previous years.
You have the comeback player of the year in Buster Posey, hands down.
Yeah, I think obviously Buster Posey, you know, will probably win, and I'll, you know, congratulations to him if he wins. But, you know, like you said, we would be ecstatic if Braun won it, you know, back to back. But otherwise, I think this is going to be a very close race, unlike the AL, where we think Trout's just going to win. With a healthy lead over Cabrera, I don't think if Posey were to lose, that Braun would win by a huge margin, and vice versa. If Posey wins and Braun loses, I don't think that is going to be a huge margin. Maybe 2-3 votes.
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, with the finalists in there, it's, if you use the playoffs as the argument, the winner is very clear. If the writers kind of go off script and pick... You know, we'll say Braun because he would probably be the next most likely candidate. It would be interesting in a lot of different ways, but I think I've learned enough about how this game operates from the award side of things over the years that it really is not Ryan Braun's award this year.
Yeah, I mean, we hate to say that as Brewers fans, but it's more than likely the truth. Buster Posey just... really did a lot of things right this season.
Pretty much everything, yeah.
Yeah, coming back from that ankle injury in 2011 to a very strong 2012, that's quite an accomplishment. Last thing that I think we can talk about today, because I just thought of it halfway through this show, was really the use of PEDs and things like that, because we just saw about a week or two ago Yasmani Grandal, the catcher for the San Diego Padres, was busted for it. and is now suspended 50 games. And obviously we have the thing this year with Melky Cabrera. A lot of people think that guys like Barry Bonds, guys like Mark McGwire, guys like Sammy Sosa should be all in the Hall of Fame because they say, well, steroids, you know, don't improve your hand-eye coordination and blah, 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 blah. That's fine. Obviously, Barry Bonds had Hall of Fame numbers before he was really linked to steroids, and that's fine. But the fact that he is linked to steroids, the fact that Roger Clemens is linked to steroids, that Mark McGwire is linked to steroids, and these PED users, I think regardless of how well they did before the fact that they use them should automatically disqualify them. And if you do put them in the Hall of Fame, then you have to put an asterisk by their name saying this guy used a substance.
You know, it's an interesting discussion, especially like in the case of Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, and I'll say Barry Bonds. Although Barry Bonds is a little bit different because Barry Bonds was never implicated. Well, was never officially charged with anything other than obstruction of justice. When Mark McGwire was found to be using these supplements and these performance-enhancing drugs, the things that he was using were not banned by Major League Baseball at the time. And that makes... I mean, that makes for a legitimate argument because... if they weren't banned, he wasn't the only one using it, A. And, I mean, that's really kind of where the discussion starts and ends, I think. And, you know, I was just reading up on this and watching some stuff about it for something else I'm doing just a couple days ago. When that came out, you remember Bud Selig walked into, like, four or five different Milwaukee-area drugstores and, like, supplement shops. And just found those on the shelves for sale. This stuff that Mark McGwire was using. So, and I think you have legitimate cases for Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa before they were linked to steroids also, with Hall of Fame numbers. It's really a tough case because, I mean, to say that Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Eddie Matthews, you know, and even, you know, pitchers like Christy Mathewson and you know, people from the beginning of baseball, if you think that these people weren't trying to get an edge also, I mean, that's an entirely different discussion about naivety, I think. It definitely has always happened. And if you want to make the Hall of Fame about character, that's one thing, and we can certainly set up a Hall of Fame about character. And most of the players in it are probably not players you would consider Hall of Fame players. We live in a different time where media coverage is constant and at times ethically gray. And we live in a time where, you know, baseball and sports performance in general is also kind of an ethical gray area. If you want them to be fantastic ball players, that's one thing. If you want them to be fantastic ball players and fantastic people, that's quite a different story.
Yeah, because there's always been the discussion that if you allow Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire into the Hall of Fame, then you have to allow Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame, which this is where we get into the discussion about character.
Right.
Pete Rose, obviously, you know, bet on his team, is banned from baseball and blah, 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 blah. You know the story.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still not okay with it. I never will be. The fact that these guys get into the Hall of Fame, I won't be okay with that. But, you know, nobody really knows what goes on behind the scenes. But a lot of people like to bring up the physical aspect of how you look at Barry Bonds in, like, 1991, 1992, and then you look at him in 2003, and his head's, like, five times bigger, and his muscles are five times bigger, and you can see the physical difference in guys that are, you know, juicing. Mm-hmm. It's become a lot less noticeable to this day, but you never saw that with like guys like DiMaggio and Willie Mays. You never really saw them bulk up and be huge players. I mean,
well, right. I'm not saying that they did steroids the way that we know them. Chemically, the processes to make, you know, anabolic steroids didn't really exist. But to say they weren't using, you know, like dreamies as they called them back then, and, you know, using amphetamines. Or, I mean, We still allow people to chew tobacco on the field, and, you know, chewing tobacco can give people a boost of energy and can, you know, temporarily increase their focus to some degree. And, you know, I mean, these are ways to get an edge also.
Yeah, apparently they didn't work too well with Josh Hamilton, though.
Right.
but
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the discussion comes into the fact that we want athletes to be everyday all-American heroes, where they come up from, you know, the cornfields of Oklahoma, like the Mick did, or, you know, we want them to come from these incredibly tough backgrounds like Jackie Robinson and Hank Aaron, and not to take anything away from any of those guys, but we want them to be these really mythical heroes, and it either has to be that that just can't happen anymore, because the competitive business nature of the game, you know, and we need to come to the point where we need to accept that, A, baseball players are people just like us, and a lot of people, when presented with an advantage one way or another, will take said advantage, and we need to maybe accept that sports as a part of society isn't the same standard bearer as it used to be. It's now entertainment. It's now financially viable, you know, money maker. And maybe people need to accept that more as it is. And in terms of steroids and these types of things, they're able to get, there are anabolic steroids that are illegal. Human growth hormone and other forms of steroids that can increase performance aren't illegal. And really, I think if it's available for most people to do on a legal standpoint, if it's legally acceptable for people to obtain these kinds of procedures and supplements and what have you, whether or not it's physically dangerous and whether or not it sets a bad example, I mean, if they need to have a talk about responsibility with children, that's something that needs to be done by parents and coaches and stuff on their own. I guess the argument about it is more based morally than anything else, and at that, on a constitutional level and a legal level, it's almost fuzzy at best.
Yeah, it's really such a slippery slope with some people, because, like, you look 40 years ago when the pitcher Doc Ellis threw that no-hitter on LSD, and you have to wonder, how did these players get past, you know, their coaches and things by being on these certain things for so long? I mean, let's take the case of Yasmani Grandal,
mm-hmm.
who got busted on November 6th. How do you go through the season and nobody really knows this? It kind of sets up the future of baseball as very uncertain. I'm making up words now. It makes baseball very uncertain as to what's to come. And you don't even know right now who could be, you know, quote-unquote juicing. Jose Canseco, the conspiracy theorist, baseball player guy, who if you follow on Twitter is absolutely hilarious. And I don't mean hilarious in the sense that he's funny. It's just the things he says are just sometimes just flat out embarrassing that it just makes you laugh.
Right.
You know, he, in a sense, he does have a lot of things that he has said that certain players are doing this, and it makes you wonder how many players that we know about, that we glorify, are doing these certain things. And, it's very, very scary to think about that, because you find out about that, and you're just like, wow, I can't watch baseball anymore because it's that. You know, it's a bunch of cheaters. It's a bunch of people trying to get an advantage, which, yes, is the human aspect of, yeah, they want to try to get better. But baseball in American society sees that as these players need to be pure. These players need to do it, you know, through their own pure strength, which I do agree with, because I think a game like baseball has just been so sacred not only to this country but to just our culture that we start tainting it. What do we have left?
See, and I hold an opinion about performance-enhancing drugs that's probably not necessarily as popular. I think that looking at the reality of the situation, looking at where we are in modern times and looking at where we've come from you know, you look at the 70s and 80s and you look at, I mean, there was a massive scandal about cocaine and amphetamine usage in Major League Baseball then. And it came through just fine. Baseball has had, you know, multiple labor disputes since the beginning of free agency and the unionizing of MLB players. And baseball has come through just fine. Baseball's not going anywhere. The game itself is not going to go anywhere. And largely, I believe that many players are probably playing the game clean. I don't see it outside of more like staunch and more puritanical values. I don't see it as that harmful to the game, because as we see, you know, players aren't hitting 150 home runs a year. Players aren't knocking in, you know, 400 RBIs a year. Players aren't, you know, perennially batting over 400 and winning, you know, 30 games a year. This isn't, you know, it's not like we have these amazing giant robot players out there that are just programmed to do nothing but hit balls and pitch really well. It's still a game of ups and downs and breaks and momentum and rhythm and all of these other things that you can't put into your body chemically, you know? And I think if we want to have a discussion about the moral implications of performance-enhancing drugs, that's a completely different story about performance-wise, because you still see players like Bryce Harper and Mike Trout coming up out of nowhere and doing really well, and you see players like R.A. Dickey reinventing himself with a new way to deceive batters.
Yeah,
I just don't see it as big of an issue as I think much of society wants to make it out to be.
Well, it's an issue because it's a professional thing. You're supposed to be a professional player that has gotten here through your own, basically, skill. And I think it's a huge letdown to know that a lot of players, and like you said, I think the majority of them are clean. I think 90% of baseball players are clean. I could be wrong about that, but I don't know. But it's a huge thing because people want to see these guys do well from their own standards, from their own upbringings, not through the help of PEDs. I definitely think that PEDs should not start to be more accepted than they are right now. I think that actually, I think the suspensions are a little bit too lenient. 50 games, yeah, people might say, well, that's a lot. Well, no, I think it should be a season. I think if you really, and it's not going to solve the problem if you suspend them for a year. It will definitely increase, you know, a lot more fear into doing it, but people aren't going to stop. It's just, it kind of makes me wonder, though, with younger players like Grandal from the Padres, and you even see a lot of minor leaguers are now starting to get busted with it. It makes you wonder if it starts there, and if it just continues on through a career, and sometimes you'll never find out about it. But with the younger generation of baseball players coming in, it makes you wonder, where does this start and when does it stop, if it ever stops? There are a lot of factors about PEDs that, you know, we can't attribute to players. The whole hand-eye coordination thing, we can't attribute that to PEDs. That's a whole thing that a person has to do on their own. You know, but they do help give you that extra boost. Now, they could say the same things about, you know, like the five-hour energy things. If, you know, a player takes that, is that considered an illegal substance because it helps keep them more awake, it gives them more energy, things like that, like you brought up earlier about the tobacco. It's just so many different things that it's hard to control, almost, but I just don't want baseball to get more lenient with these kind of things. These suspensions need to be harsher, the penalties need to be harsher, and it's just, it's not going to kill the problem, but it's a step in the right direction if they want to try and make baseball, end quote, a pure game, because you're taking away a lot of what baseball means to people, because then you're just seeing it as a game of cheaters.
Well, and I think it's kind of silly. Obviously, no offense to the people that hold, you know, that kind of opinion, but the curveball was banned from baseball when it was first invented. Lou Burdett might have thrown a spitter. You know, Satchel Paige had many trick pitches, illegal substances on the ball, excessive pine tar, corked bats. This isn't anything new. You know, to say that baseball was ever a pure game, you know, and then we bring up things about the segregation of baseball, not allowing Latin players to play, not allowing African American players to play, and people saying when Jackie Robinson, when people started drafting and signing a lot more black players, they had an unfair advantage because black players were just supernaturally better than whites. I mean, these are things that really existed, you know, catchers that first started wearing shin guards were considered cheaters because they weren't playing the same way as other catchers. It's, the game's never been pure to the pure standards that, you know, many baseball enthusiasts would like. The DH is another example. Obviously it's a little bit different with using chemical substances, but if it's not illegal for these, if there's not a federal or state law against them having these sorts of things, and I don't know where federal or state laws exist in terms of obtaining steroids, I don't see it as big of an issue, personally.
I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I really do, because baseball has changed in many sorts of ways, but I just see the whole steroid issue as this kind of, nail in the coffin towards baseball if it were to just be widely accepted. I don't think it should be widely accepted because that is a dramatic change. It basically allows people to cheat the system that so many people have tried to, you know, play their whole lives, you know, being the players they are, being these legends they are, Babe Ruth, Ted Williams, Nolan Ryan, being the legends they are today, it kind of almost takes what they worked for and turns into nothing a little bit. I don't think that the changes, like you said, the shin guards or the DH, things like that, were too dramatic. I think those type of things make baseball a little bit more interesting, but it's not a huge thing to where it would dramatically change baseball for the next 20, 30 years. I think implementing steroids into a more accepting society would. I feel like that just overturns the table in baseball. I just don't think it's something that needs to be in baseball. I mean,
I think if steroids were as big of an issue as we imagine steroids to be, you'd see a lot more younger players having this issue. You don't see a whole lot of young players really getting caught with these things. Much smarter than the testers.
We do see it in the minor leagues a little bit more, though. Now.
Well, yeah, you do see it in the minor leagues wherever there's a lot more pressure. And where there's a lot more pressure is when you have a minor league player who's been in the league, who's been in the minors for a few years, and you see it with aging players who are trying to extend their career. I.e. Andy Pettit, Roger Clemens, to some degree Alex Rodriguez, and Rafael Palmeiro when he was one of the biggest names when that whole thing went down. Eric Gagne was well into his career when he was named in the Mitchell Report. I don't think it's an epidemic the way that people who are arguing against steroids on the front lines would like you to believe. It's certainly always going to be an issue, and as long as it's banned from Major League Baseball, yes, I would prefer that all the players that I care about do not use steroids. From a constitutional aspect, it's very fuzzy the way that Major League Baseball goes about it. From a legality issue, it's a gray area, I believe. And it's something that's never going to be solved. Whatever they ban, players are going to find a new way to take that edge. Whatever they, you know, want to get around, they're going to get around. It's never going to change. Baseball is a game that is steeped in taking advantages away from the other team and giving them to you, either on a personal basis or on a team basis, because the Baltimore Orioles for a long time used to grow their outfield grass a lot longer. The Yankees had a drain pipe in center field that they used to keep uncovered. The Orioles also used to, you know, dry out the front of, you know, in front of their home plate in order to get bunts down better. I mean, it just, this is just what happens.
Yeah, I mean, in all those sorts of forms of baseball that have happened throughout the years, I don't condone, I don't think they're right, but it happens, and we've learned from it. And learning from that, I think, prevents any major things happening, whether it be steroids issue or something completely else. As long as it's illegal by baseball, it needs to be stopped. And I just don't see that's an issue that's overturning, and I don't think it will overturn, honestly. In the day, if it ever were, I would probably just stop watching baseball, to be quite honest. I know it sounds a little bit dramatic, but it's just, the steroids thing would just do it for me. I understand, you know, there have been things in the past, people will say, you know, like you brought up, like, we don't know the amphetamines or things people may have been on in the 40s and 50s and 60s back then. But I just feel like that's just too much of a tipping point at this stage, because they have been trying to crack down a little bit more on it. And, you know, we saw it last year with Ryan Braun, that whole thing. And now we see it this year with Melky Cabrera, and just things like that. And it's not even so much the smaller name players that are being involved with it, you know, guys that we never even really heard of or guys that are in the minors. I mean, it's bigger name players sometimes, too. And I think the 90s and into the 2000s really had that time shift from, you know, like I said, quote-unquote, and I say this really in air quotes, is the pure baseball into this baseball that has evolved into today that just has really flipped the norm a lot on a lot of things, because you have, you know, certain things, not even PEDs, but like these HGH, like what Andy Pettit had, to try and sometimes cure injuries, not so much to improve their game, but to try and heal from injuries and things like that, or things like that. You know, a detriment to baseball. This whole discussion is a really slippery slope. And my final thing on it is just that steroids should not be a part of this game. Now, unfortunately, they are. It's going to be here for a long time. It's an issue that's not going to dissipate overnight. But it needs to be cracked down on a little bit harder. And I think Selig knows this. But Selig needs to do a better job of it. I think they need to start testing players more. I think the whole thing with Ryan Braun, testing him over time, sure, that's fine. Test him 3-4 days a week. But test every other player as well. I think it's wrong to just single out one guy you think was linked to it because, you know, he got off on a technicality. I think if you want to make this game try and work and get past all these issues, you have to try and test these guys more often than when you are. But...
And, you know, it's funny because we have unprecedented labor peace in baseball right now. We have off-the-chart attendance and revenue coming into the game. People aren't watching games, you know, they aren't watching the playoffs on television as much as they used to, but you still have, I mean, you have an incredible boon to baseball right now in terms of fan involvement, fan interest, and, you know, overall just discussion about the game. And I don't really think that – I think the system that's in place right now I think is great for what baseball is doing for its stance on steroids as it is. Now, if this was 1997, 1998, 1999, 2000, yeah, we can have a huge discussion about this. I think baseball is doing just fine in terms of performance-enhancing drugs, considering the fact that it turned a complete blind eye to it after the labor strike. But I think that, legitimately, I don't have an issue with the way baseball is conducting itself right now, and I don't think the game's going anywhere anytime soon. You look at these massive stadiums, you look at all the people flooding in and out of them, you look at, you know, the continued interest over very long seasons, and you look at the fact that baseball is the only sport right now that is under zero labor threat. And I don't see it going anywhere. And I think baseball's smart enough to toe that line between, you know, being overbearing with the rules the way that the NFL is being, and being completely lackluster, the way that the NBA is, in terms of enforcing its own policies. I think Major League Baseball has struck a very good balance and looks very strong for the future.
You know, that brings up a point moving on from the steroid issue is, the whole instant replay thing. You know, they have been trying to make more of a stronger push for that in the playoffs, which I think, here's my stance on the instant replay thing. Instant replay should be in every playoff game, and in September, it should be in the games that matter, that have playoff, you know, contention about them. Not like, you know, Royals Twins game that's, you know, they're both way out. No, I think that if you want to start off with instant replay in baseball, it has to be for the more critical games first. It's a very long process. It's obviously not going to happen while Bud Selig's still commissioner. That's why he's been really hush-hush about it. He hasn't really said much about it at all, because, you know, he's going to want to get out of there soon. So I think this is an issue that will eventually happen over time, maybe in the next 5 years. I don't know. But I think instant replay is something that definitely needs to be implemented in October baseball, because we saw a lot more this season. And I heard this from fans of every team about how bad the umpires were behind the plate in some instances, and how awful, you know, the strike zones were. It'd be huge for one pitcher and small for another one, and batters were taking balls, and it would frustrate pitchers because they'd be throwing them at the knees and it'd be called a ball, and then pitchers would, you know, throw it on the inside to be called a strike, and they just couldn't find that consistency. Batters would get called a strike at their ankles. And it's just, I think instant replay is an interesting idea for MLB. It's something that needs to seriously be considered and probably implemented for October at least. But overall, I don't know if it'll ever actually happen in the entirety of the game.
Here's my stance on instant replay. Fair foul, home runs, close plays at the bag, and close plays at the plate. If you want to challenge balls and strikes, you have to do it on a challenge system, the way that the NFL does it. You have to do it where, you know, the manager gets two or three challenges a game.
Before, like, the next pitch would be thrown. Kind of like how they do that in football before the next snap.
Right. And I would venture a guess that I would venture make it even safer that maybe only called third strikes. Because you look at a game that doesn't have a time limit, and replays take, in football at least, replays take up to 2 minutes. And, I mean, that's just difficult to just have, like, on a 1-1 call, you're calling a ball and a strike. You're gonna want to replay on a ball and a strike. On an 0-1 call, you're going to challenge a call for a strike. It makes it very difficult. I think instant replays for called balls and strikes is difficult, because if you're behind as a batter in a count, you have to be defensive anyways. And if you're looking 1-2 and you're looking at a ball near the knees, I mean, maybe you should be swinging at that anyways.
Yeah, I think, like, the third strike called challenge that you brought up, I think is very interesting. But I think that should be only to the discretion of the manager. You know, the player can argue all they want, but unless the manager sees something, because obviously the manager sees something a lot different than what the batter does, because obviously different points of view, different perspectives. So unless the manager were to see something, I think they could challenge it. But unless not, I think it would still be the same. I like that system you brought up, home runs, foul balls, close plays at bags, home plate, stuff like that. I think that's a lot more realistic than doing it in every game and trying to analyze every little thing that goes down, because you can't. Baseball, in the end, is a human game. There's going to be the human error that factors into it. But the human error doesn't need to factor into it when you have a team that's on the verge of making the playoffs and doesn't because, you know, there's a bad call. Like, look at that play. If it was either last year or this year, I think it was last year, when the Braves played the Pirates in that 19-inning game, and the guy was clearly out, and they called him safe at home, which ended the game. Things like that, I'm just like, you have to have some form of replay there to overturn that, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and I mean, close plays at the plate and close plays at the back, I think, are absolutely should be on the table for instant replay. The only thing that I think shouldn't be is balls and strikes, because at some point, take the bat off your shoulder. Like, if there's one run and you're down in the count anyways, you know, you should be swinging at anything close. You should be trying to make contact, have a defensive swing, foul something off, you know, make an effort to be part of that game.
Yeah, I totally agree, because that's the human factor of this game. It is up to you. It's not going to be all up to instant replay. And that's what I feel also, that players might try to rely on it too much, that the system might be a little bit abused. But yet again, I think that's something that should be more up to the manager's discretion and not the players, because you have 25 players on a roster and one manager. So I think the guys calling the shots, just like in football, need to be the ones that challenge the plays.
Oh, absolutely, and I don't think you'd ever have a system where the inmates would be running the asylum, to use a tired expression. But I think that, you know, when Selig does end up stepping down, I think the next commissioner that will be number one on their plate, I mean, Selig has done he has done a lot of things right for the game, and he's done a lot of things bad for the game. I mean, obviously you have steroids, you have the initial strike, which, I mean, he came in during the strike shortening season, but I think he, you know, expanding the playoffs in my mind has made baseball more interesting, at least for diehard baseball fans, giving you that extra impetus to root for your team come late August and early September. But I think instant replay is just too political for him at this point. It's something he doesn't need to do. He's done a lot for the game as the way that he sees it, I'm sure. And he's done enough in the terms of many fans, I think, that instant replay will be left to the next guy.
You know, all I can say about this is thank God David Stern doesn't do baseball. Instead of basketball reasons, we'd have baseball reasons. And it would just be a mess. Well, is there anything else you would like to talk about? Because we've already hit, I think, the 2-hour mark, which is new record for us. Yeah,
new record. Absolutely. I think we've gone far above and beyond what anyone was expecting today. So
yeah, I wonder if there's like a certain point where people will just stop listening.
we can just start saying weird stuff and see what happens. So
yeah, like, you know, yeah. Did you hear that time when Ryan Braun was going to the Yankees?
Ryan Braun is the new Yankee right fielder. He's switching positions and everything.
Yeah, Ichiro's coming to Milwaukee. Tim Lincecum's going to I don't know where Tim Lincecum would go. He's going somewhere that's not the Giants. crazy stuff. We're getting teams in England and Spain and Germany. And, you know, we'll see if people listen to this point. But
right.
Anyway, I think we've definitely hit the mark for today. We're going to try to do this again in 2 weeks on the 28th. So, and after that, we'll have two more shows for the rest of this year before we start back in January. So by then, we'll be out of the Baseball Arizona Fall League. We'll be into the Dominican League, which for Brewers fans, Taylor Green's going to be there. Who else is going to be there? I forget.
I haven't heard a whole lot about the Dominican League quite yet, but we'll definitely be up on it for the next show.
Yeah, no, so keep your eyes out for Taylor Green and any other Brewers that we forgot to mention today, because as we know, this is a Brewer show, and we talked about 5% of the Brewers today, and the rest was, you know, baseball and stuff like that. I feel like now would be an appropriate time to like throw in something about like Tim Tebow and talk about that, but
right.
Which that whole thing, I'm just like, I kind of want to start the whole thing like free Tim Tebow on Twitter, because I was watching a video earlier of Skip Bayless talking about it and how like Sanchez has like one of the worst quarterback ratings, and just that whole mess with the Jets is just kind of funny to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, guys. Well, thank you for listening, and as always, stay tuned for next week. 2 weeks. Yeah, 2 weeks. Yeah.
We'll see you next time, guys.
Yeah.